think we'll begin. Good morning, everyone. And thanks for braving the weather, those who are here. It's quite
a...
As we say in Yiddish, it was ploching before, and I said, oops, yeah. I don't think I'm going to have a crowd today. But look, here you are, look at that. Okay, so we're week four. So last week, we began discussing the chapter that talks about finding purpose, which was divided into three parts, just to refresh your memory. The first part was importance of purpose and the emptiness that exists when one doesn't have purpose. The second was the concept of bitul, or bitul, as Sarah liked to say it, which was the concept of getting rid of the ego, surrendering, moving away from self in order to achieve purpose. And the third was finding purpose. Now, last week we covered the first two. We'll just give a quick review and then go on to the third today. Also link it to the chapter after that, which is sort of connected. So just to review a little bit. So she started off talking about the Viktor Frankl story where he told someone who said that I no longer expect anything from life. And to which Viktor Frankl said that life expects something from you. Which was similar to the story of the Alter Rebbe, as I told you, that he told his chassid, you have a long shopping list, you're saying what you need, but you're not saying what you are needed for. And as we explained last week, it's not a contradiction to having needs. And we pray for needs, and we're supposed to, but we're supposed to pray for it in the right context. In other words, using the resources and the gifts that God gives us for purpose. Right? We talk about the soul is the thing that drives purpose, and the sense of emptiness when the soul isn't fed because the soul is not being fulfilled, it's not achieving the purpose. That was the first part of last week. The second is we talked about this concept of humility, or bitul, as the Hasidic term is. And as she said, that the ego starves the soul. I thought that was a very good way to put it. And what it does is it strengthens the klippah, it strengthens the shell, the body, the animal soul that hides and conceals and covers over the soul, and it doesn't give the ability for the soul to be expressed. Now, as we said, in order to find purpose, one has to get rid of that ego, because ego means all about me and not about a higher purpose, about what I need, selfishness, but not about a greater meaning and a greater purpose. So therefore, we need this concept of bitul, which is self-nullification, but it's a hard concept, as we said. Right, it's a hard idea. And people struggle with that idea. It's a very hard thing to move away from ego, or to surrender, or to self-negate, even in a positive way. So as we explained last week, she begins by describing the concept is that bitul is the shift of mindset from I am everything to I am not everything. But we took it a lot deeper last week to explain that bitul actually means not that I'm not everything, I'm actually nothing. But nothing means nothing as an independent being. And that's why we have that concept of matzah to start off with, which is the complete surrender. Once we do that, then we can reintroduce self, but in a different context completely. Because we do have a unique mission, and God has given us talents and abilities and skills, which we have to then use for our purpose. So bitul is, we'll talk a bit more about it today, because it's actually a very deep and liberating, difficult but liberating concept. So it is about complete self-negation in a positive way, to remember that we are a very weak existence if we are independent. We're a very weak existence if we think that we are self-made. But part of the process is surrendering to become nothing in order to become part of a greater reality, which is the reality of the infinity of God, so to speak. Okay. Just to add to that a little bit before we go on to this week's concept, or the follow-on from that, we know that when the Jews got the Torah, one of the greatest famous phrases that we read about, that God was pleased, so to speak, that the Jews were able to respond when they were asked about receiving the Torah, is this concept of Na'aseh V'Nishma, right? The fact they said Na'aseh V'Nishma. Na'aseh V'Nishma means we will do and then we'll understand. Basically meaning that they were prepared to commit without knowing what they're in for. Like they were ready to commit even though they wouldn't understand anything, right? Which in a way is an unbelievable level of what we're talking about. It's unbelievable level. Right, come in. It's an unbelievable level of bitul, of really surrender, complete surrender. But what's interesting is if you look carefully at that phrase, and it just brings up the point again, right? The phrase that is in the Talmud about how great the Jews was when they surrendered before God gave the Torah was Naseh v'nishma, we will do and then we'll understand, right? Now, it could have been even stronger. It could have been that they just said, we'll do, right? But that's not what the Talmud says. The Talmud says the greatness was Naseh and then Nishma. We will do and then we'll understand. It's exactly the point that we said before about Matzah and Chametz coming later. Because the God doesn't want just Naseh. He wanted Naseh to come first. He wanted that complete surrender to be first. In other words, leave yourselves, go out of your Egypt, surrender completely to a higher being, find that purpose, and then I want you to understand, because I want you to absorb it. I want you should serve me and fulfill the purpose with every part of who you are, including your brain and your unique brain and your unique emotions and your unique personality. That is very important. The Nishma is very important just in the right order. Right? So, Bitul is not a balance between self and not self. Bitul is completely not self, graduating to a much higher being, much higher reality, which then includes bringing every part of who we are into that reality. And in fact, gives us more potential and more infinity and greater greatness, but in a context of not self, not a focus on self. It's a difficult sort of process, journey. As I said last week, it's a hard thing to actually achieve, but we develop the mindset at least, and we try move in that direction. Okay. So then once there's that commitment to move away from self, then she went to the third thing, which we didn't do last week, and that is we move on to the concept of finding purpose. So she begins that chapter with a very important part of finding purpose, which is all true, and I want to sort of explore it a bit, but I want to add to it, sort of deepen it a little bit like we did with the Bitul. So she writes like this. She says, one way to start finding your purpose is to discover your strengths, right? You need to investigate what activities make you feel content and strong. What she means by that is there's no benefit in trying to copy someone else's purpose, even if it looks cool and impressive. In other words, when we work, when we move our life, when we conduct a life based on our own ego, part of the ego is to copy other people, to keep up an image, to make sure that our superficiality is fed and strong, right? Which often means that we end up doing things because other people do them, or to look better or equal to other people, even though it's not really what we're about, right? Okay, so therefore that's a good point. So she says, therefore we need to know what our strengths are, okay? She says, I learned that when I started my own company for the wrong reasons. In the same way, your soul is unique, so are your passion and purpose. Now, that is all true. Purpose means you need to use your strength in order to what God gave you. Your talents, your strength, your uniqueness. It is also true that every soul is unique, which goes back to the point we said last week, Bishvili Nivra Olam, for me the world was created. In other words, I have a specific mission to achieve in this world, otherwise God didn't need me as another extra. Each one has another thing to bring to the table. And the concept here of using strengths for purpose, it doesn't mean because someone discovers their strength that necessarily they will use it for a good thing. Right, people could use their strengths in an egocentric way as well. But the idea here is that we discover what our strength is and then we use that for good. It's our strength, our uniqueness, and we use it. We use it for good things, we use it to help people, we use it to achieve things, we use it for something that is deeper, something that is higher, something that is purposeful. Right. Now, she makes an interesting point. She says when she talks about strengths, right, when I work with, because she's worked with people in corporate settings and businesses and things like that, she says, when I work with leaders on finding their strengths, I take a totally different approach to what you'd imagine. I don't focus on what they are good at. That's an interesting thing. That she says strength is not something that you're good at. I base my discovery journey with them on uncovering who they were originally supposed to become. What she says is that strengths is something that I'll just read you the line. There are the things that when you do them, they make you feel in flow as if you were born to do these activities. They feel natural to you. Because often people might be good at something, but it's actually not them. Just because you're good at something, it doesn't mean that's your strength. Right? So she just clarifies that when she talks about the concept of finding your strength. Okay. So therefore, her thesis here, her concept is here that you find purpose by discovering your strengths, meaning your true strengths. What is it that makes you feel good? What is it that makes you feel that you're achieving the purpose? What is it that makes you feel like you were always meant to do that kind of thing? Which, by the way, often people... obviously, it goes together with being good at something or at least becoming good at something, right? In other words, it might be something that you were always meant to do, and it needs practice in order to become that. That's fine, because life is about hard work, particularly life which is a life of meaning and purpose. Okay. So all this is true, right? All this is true. Everyone is unique. That is true. It is true that we should express and nurture our purpose through our strengths. That is also true. Everyone has a different personality. Everyone has a different way of doing things. And that is all true. And also on one level, which we'll see not true on all levels, our souls are different. And every soul is unique. That is all true, right? And therefore, not everyone's purpose is identical, right? Not everyone's purpose is the same. Everyone has a different mission in life, and that's true. And finding your purpose is a difficult thing, actually, right? Finding your unique purpose is a very difficult thing. People often discover it very late. People go through... It requires that bitul that we talked about last week. It requires that surrender of actually not so much thinking about self, but thinking about what is the good that I can do? What am I meant to do? How am I going to contribute to making the world a better place? How am I going to contribute to a higher form of living? So that in itself is a big process. And even then, now that I'm ready to do that, if I'm ready to do that, so what is it that I'm supposed to do? Right, what is it I'm supposed to... And you find that people, to use the Yiddish term, fablonja a lot in life. They like sort of get lost in life. They end up doing things that they really... It's clear at the end they weren't meant to be doing that. So how you do that is hard. We'll come back to that a little bit later. But it is true that we all have unique strengths. It is true that we should express our purpose through those strengths and through those specific skill sets and so on. And it is also true that every soul is unique. However, sorry to the however point, it's not entirely accurate. And I'll tell you why. Because I want to talk about purpose in a Jewish context, which we normally do here. We talk about based on Jewish wisdom. And finding purpose and living a life of purpose from a Jewish point of view is far deeper than that. Meaning it includes finding your strengths. It includes expressing your purpose through your strengths. But it's not just that. Okay. Now, just a surgeon's warning. What I'm about to say is going to sound very demanding and difficult and challenging, okay? But that's okay, because that's what we're supposed to do. We're supposed to challenge ourselves, right? And I'm saying that because I hope that... I'm going to say it the way it is, because that's what I always do. I hope, I try at least, to be intellectually honest. And it means no judgment, right? Because everyone is on a different journey. All right, but there's a certain mindset that I do want to address here, which I think is important to understand from a Jewish point of view if you really want to live a life of what Jewish wisdom calls purpose. Okay, it's very challenging also because we all have an ego, which we've talked about. None of us are exempt. Anyone doesn't have an ego in this room, anyone has no ego, you're in the wrong place. Because most human beings do have an ego. In fact, Jewish writings talk about in every generation only very, very unique people. God sometimes splatters a few people here and there who are completely holy and have no ego. So we all have an ego, and therefore it's always difficult to leave that ego behind. It's a lifelong journey. It's a lifelong process. Going out of Mitzrayim is something we do all the time, going out of our own ego, beyond ourselves. In fact, that's rooted in the whole concept which I mentioned many times, that when the Jews left Egypt, the Torah talks about leaving Egypt in the plural, right? The journeys, not the journey from Egypt, but the Torah talks about the journeys from Egypt, because from when the Jews left Egypt until they finally reached their destination, which was the land of Israel, they went to 42 steps, 42 journeys, because it's a lifelong mission, so it takes a long time, right? Now, in the Jewish context, in order to find real meaning, the way God sees meaning, at least, The biggest impediment to finding purpose, as she described herself in the book, is ourselves. Right? We stand in our own way, basically. And as I said, no one is exempt from this and no one is immune from this, because we all stand in our own way on some level, because we all get stuck with self-interest, and we all get stuck with self-bias, we all get stuck with self-preservation, and we all get stuck with egocentric feelings, and so on and so forth. Right? So, at the end of the day, what stands in the way of meaning, purpose, true happiness, sense of inner fulfillment is ourselves, right? And therefore, we have to be able to leave ourselves. And going back to the concept of bittul, which we said last week, which, as I said, is a very hard concept, what I want to share with you is it is a very hard concept. It's one of the most difficult things, but it's also one of the most liberating things. And I'm going to explain why. Right? It's extremely, extremely, extremely difficult and extremely liberating. Okay, let's understand. Let's break this down a bit. Right? So from a Jewish point of view, and again, this is sort of, again, it can be challenging. From a Jewish point of view, purpose must come from a completely objective source. Like Rabbi Sacks writes, Rabbi Sacks in his writings on morality, right, talks about the true meaning of morality. We've spoken about this before. So there's what we call subjective morality and objective morality, or absolute morality, right? Subjective morality is what people decide is moral, which you will see, you will notice fluctuates from one generation to the next, from one society to the next, and keeps on changing, right? Things which generations ago were considered moral or immoral, today that's opposite around, whatever, right? Because people have different perceptions. Generally in today's society, morality is defined by, am I hurting someone or not, right? If I'm not hurting anyone, I can do whatever I want. If I'm hurting someone, that's immoral, right? Now, obviously hurting someone else is not a good idea, and it is an immoral thing. But that, from the Torah point of view, from Jewish point of view, that's not the definition of morality. I'm just giving you an example. Morality is more of an intrinsic right or wrong, right? So there are things that Judaism or Torah would consider wrong or immoral even, which not hurting anyone, right? Why am I saying that? Because Rabbi Sacks discusses in his book that the true meaning of morality from a Jewish point of view can only come from a source outside of the system. In other words, when the system is the one that defines what's going to be moral for the system, then it doesn't work. Because you're always stuck in the system. And the system is self-serving. So the system serves the system. You with me?
Yeah.
And therefore will define its success or its system according to the system. That means you never left the system. In Judaism, the challenging demand, but the liberating demand is that there's a way to go beyond the system, which is to connect to God. And therefore, when you connect to God, the idea is that you're leaving yourself, that's the concept of bittul, as we told last week. You're leaving yourself completely. And when you leave yourself completely, you're connecting to something which is a higher being, which we call God. A higher being, a being which is outside of the system, transcends the system, is infinite, not like the infinity of the system, sees a much bigger picture, sees the system from the outside, and is able to guide and instruct and inform the system what is purposeful and what is not, what is true, what is false, and what is purposeful and what is not purposeful. Right? Now, as I said, that's a very difficult idea, particularly in today's society. Because today's society is very me-focused. People don't like to leave themselves, right? There are people that search for meaning. They want to do something good. They want to feel that they've done something valuable, but not at the cost of themselves, right? That's just the way we all work like that, but today it's like humongously emphasized, right? So therefore, submitting or surrendering to something beyond myself, people generally and particularly nowadays find extremely difficult. Yet if one is able to at least develop that mindset, that surrender, at least when we talk about surrendering to something like God, it's actually a very liberating thing. Because actually I'm in God's hands. I'm surrendering myself to something much higher than myself. I'm becoming part of something that's a much greater reality for myself. Much more infinite, much greater. But it takes work. Because I've got to go beyond myself. I've got to leave myself behind. Right? Therefore, from the Jewish wisdom point of view, finding purpose is not just about doing good things that make you feel good. Or that are in truth good. True purpose, true leaving of oneself, true graduating, true inner freedom, freeing ourselves from ourselves, means surrendering to something higher than ourselves, i.e. surrendering to God. Right? Now, surrendering to God by definition means that what I do or what He wants us to do is not always going to make sense to us. Because He's from out of the system. Right? And what He defines as being purposeful and good and moral and connecting is not always going to be something that talks to us. And that's fine. That's part of the process. Why do I say all that? Because while it is true that God created us with strengths, and He created us, every one of us, in a unique way, but if we pursue purpose only from the perspective of our strengths, then we've never left ourselves at the end of the day. We've done great things, done good things, but we've never left ourselves. It's like that small horse I talked about last week, right? Might be really, it's not a horse, but it's a small horse, still there. A piece of ourselves is still there. And if a piece of ourselves is still there, then we're still locked in ourselves. And we won't find the true inner fulfillment and the true meaning and the true purpose and even true happiness. It's a hard idea. True happiness actually comes from total surrender. Because then the meaning is infinite. The meaning is endless. What does that look like? So therefore, part of the strengths, part of purpose, I mean, certainly includes finding a way to express our own strengths and our own unique purpose. But it also means submitting to something godly, whether it's part of our strength or not. Okay, this is the challenging part. I said at the beginning of the series, I'm going to challenge you this time. Okay? Challenge myself, actually. We're all guilty of this, by the way. We're all, each one on our own level. Because I know everyone's on a different journey. And by the way, what I'm going to say is not about only people keeping mitzvot or not keeping mitzvot. Even people who keep a lot of mitzvot can be totally trapped in themselves. And I'm going to explain to you why. Right? But it does mean connecting to something that is not who we normally are. So I'll give you just a model that comes from the Torah, so we better understand it. Okay. We just had this in these weeks of the Torah reading, so it fits right in. When the Jews were in the desert, so God asked the Jewish people to build a sanctuary, to build a Mishkan, right? A place where He would dwell. Now, as we know, the structure of the Mishkan was not just a building, it was a model, it was a concept, not just a building. It was a building also, but it was a concept. We know this from the famous thing, I've mentioned this before, because when God told them to build a Mikdash, He said, V'asuli Mikdash, make a sanctuary for me, V'shachanti betocham, and I will dwell among them. And the commentaries are, so the grammar's wrong. I should have said, make for me a temple, V'shachanti betocho, I will dwell in it, meaning the Mishkan. So the commentaries explain, no, God was saying, build a Mishkan. The Mishkan will be a model for every human being to build a Mishkan, their own Mishkan, for God to dwell in them, in every single person, every single heart. That's the idea. Okay. So therefore, we look to the Mishkan often as to understand its structure, its physical structure, how it was built, how it was designed, how it was donated to understand what's the spiritual structure for us to live our lives to achieve purpose. So one of the things that was interesting in the Mishkan was like this. God asked Moses to ask the Jewish people to donate resources to building the Mishkan. It was a big building. It was a complicated structure. And it needed a lot of donations, right? And that was part of the process. They had come out of Egypt wealthy. Right? They had come out of Egypt really, really wealthy, well-to-do. They had taken a lot of the treasures out of Egypt. That was the whole process. before they left Egypt, they were well compensated, and they had to give of that. Sorry, they were well compensated by force. Part of the punishment for the Egyptians was that the Jews were allowed to take stuff from there, right? And they took a lot, and they were wealthy, and that was part of the promise that God had promised Abraham, that when his descendants will be enslaved, they will leave eventually, not just leave, but they'll leave berchush gadol. They will have a lot of resources. Okay. And then they had to give up some of that for building of the Mishkan. And there was like 15 materials that were necessary: gold, silver, copper, certain types of threads, dyed threads, a complicated structure. The donation divided itself into two groups. Okay. There was one donation that everyone had to give that was equal. Everyone had to give a half a shekel. Half a shekel was like a half a silver coin. Everyone had to give half a shekel. The poor, the rich, everyone had to give exactly the same thing. Doesn't matter what you own, what you don't own, everyone had to give a half a shekel. Okay. Beyond that, everyone gave whatever they wanted. Some gave more, some gave less, some gave gold, some gave silver, some gave linen materials, whatever the case is. And from that they built the different structures, the different vessels of the Mishkan, the beams, the curtains that would cover, the fancy designs, the whole thing. Now, when they built the Mishkan, what was the half shekel coins used for? Right? This one donation that everyone had to give equally, what was that used for? So that was used for, they melted them all down, and that was used for the foundation of the Mishkan. Just to explain what I mean, the Mishkan was a movable object. They used to dismantle it and put it up all the time. And it was made out of beams, so the beams were the walls, and those beams rested in very heavy silver sockets. So those silver sockets became the foundation of the Mishkan. Right? I'm making sense? Everyone's following? Okay. So that was taken from that donation. Then everything else, there was differences. There was the beams, there was the curtains, there was the altars, the candelabra, the ark, and so on and so forth. What's the symbolism behind this? So in mysticism, they explain the following. And this goes to the heart of what we're about to explain. The foundation of building a Mishkan, let's translate this into the context of what we're discussing. The foundation of our life mission, which is to bring godliness into the world, to bring higher purpose into the world, to bring value into the world. The foundation is the same for everyone. It's not unique. There's a foundational purpose and journey towards purpose that is unique to everyone. Is the same to everyone, uniform. It's that surrender. It's that doing something godly, and it's doing something that's not your strength, that's difficult for you. Translated in the Torah's point of view, what that means is God gave us a certain basic principles. He gave the Jewish people a Torah. He asked us to keep the Torah as much as best we can. So it's the mitzvot, it's the learning of Torah, which doesn't vary from person to person. Yeah, I mean, it varies in terms of the laws, like in other words, men have particular mitzvot, women have particular mitzvot, and so on. But the concept of keeping God's commandments and values, that's uniform. That's the foundation. Because that's where you surrender. That's where you graduate. That's the matzah. That's where you leave yourself and say, I'm committed to something higher than me. And everyone's committed to that something higher. Everyone's committed, everyone's surrendering to a godly power. That's why it's a half a shekel for everyone. And it's specifically half a shekel. Why not a whole shekel? Because half a shekel is the concept of surrender. It means I'm only half. I'm surrendering, humility. I'm incomplete unless I join in to a higher reality. Only then I become something complete. Right? And that was uniform for everyone. Once that bitul is there, once that surrender is there, once you've left yourself, now God says, I designed you each differently. There's also a unique purpose for every individual. And that depends on you. Whatever you can give, you give. Whatever you have, that's what you have to give. If you have gold, symbolically, you have to give gold. If you have silver, you have to give silver. Right? Let me just make this more tangible. So, for example, the Lubavitcher Rebbe would always say this. He would say, he would give an example of this idea. He would say there's some basic principles that apply to everyone. So his example would be, everyone is supposed to do good deeds. Everyone is supposed to learn Torah. He was very into everyone should have a time to learn. Right? That's everyone's commitment. No one should say like, no, my favorite mitzvah is giving charity. Or the other guy would say, my favorite mitzvah is learning. Everyone has to learn, everyone has to get charity. I'm giving you those examples, they're very different. Right? There was the famous thing where there was a partnership, there was in the 12 tribes that went into Israel, there were the two tribes called Yisachar and Zvulun. Yisachar were Torah learners, Torah scholars, Zvulun was business people. And they made a partnership, right? Yisachar sat and learnt, Zvulun did business and supported them, and they joined in with the mitzvah, right? So they were a partnership. So the Rebbe always used to say, you think that meant that Yisachar can be completely detached from the world? Or do you think that meant that Zvulun don't ever have to learn? Of course not. Everyone had to do both. It's just a matter of emphasis, a matter of your unique journey. But there's a baseline where everyone has to do it because that's part of the surrender. In other words, if we go to the beams and the curtains of the Mishkan before we have the foundation, then we've never left ourselves. We've never really graduated ourselves. We're still stuck in ourselves. Because at the end of the day, we're still us. We're still doing what might be very good things, beautiful things. But we're still who we are. We haven't graduated. We haven't gone to something more infinite. We're still stuck in the system. We haven't connected to something, a higher being outside the system, right? A similar concept, just again, going back to the Mishkan, when they designed the menorah, the candelabra, right? So very interesting design. The candelabra was a very intricate design, yes, but it was all made from one piece of gold. In fact, the Talmud says Moses didn't understand how to do it, and God had to make it out of fire. Anyway, because it was a very intricate, beautiful design, but all that to be made out of one piece of gold. And yet, the menorah, the design was, it had seven branches, and the mystics explain the same thing. It's one piece of gold because at the base, everyone's based on the same base, like the sockets of the Mishkan, right? And then everyone branches out in seven different ways, right? So what does that mean? That means two things. That means that in our life, we always have to say, what am I doing in order to, if I'm pursuing a journey of purpose, what am I doing on two levels? First of all, what am I doing that's godly? That doesn't even talk to me, but I know it's what God wants, right? We know that in the Torah, for example, there are many mitzvot that don't even have a reason. You know, at least when God gives us a lot of mitzvot that have a reason, at least we can relate to that, right? But He specifically designed certain mitzvot that don't have a reason, called chukim. What's the point of doing something there's no reason? That's the point, right? That is the point. The point is that there's a point in doing something you understand because God wants us to understand. He wants godliness to become part of who we are, part of our brain, part of our intellect, part of our emotion. And therefore He says you've got to understand as much as you can. But He also gives us the opportunity to leave ourselves. How does He do that? By giving us things we don't understand. Or don't talk to us. Or just don't have any meaning for us. So why do we do them? That's why we do them. That's exactly why we do them. To leave ourselves. To come to the recognition, to come to the understanding, the acknowledgement that we are finite people and that there's something, that we are just a speck and there's something, we can become part of something that is so much more infinite than us. But we need to surrender to it. And it also means that we can't sort of pick and choose. I've said this before, but like, again, obviously everyone's on a journey, everyone has, but this is something we have to explore. We all have to do that. We all have to take on something that we haven't taken on before. Doing something that we haven't done. You know, I've often been asked this question. I think I've shared this with you before, but I often get asked the question about people who really are spiritual people and really seeking deep depth and seeking meaning. And we have discussions, and sometimes it's particularly in the Kayyemet part of Bina, with young adults, where we sit around and we talk about these kind of ideas, either mysticism or mindfulness or whatever the case is. And I often get this question. The question is, to be spiritual, do I have to believe in God? Now, obviously, it's a provoking question to ask a rabbi. And normally they expect to get the answer, no, of course not, you have to believe in God. And what they want to know is why, right? They're challenging. What do you go for? And I always answer differently. I say, no, to be spiritual, you actually don't have to believe in God. To be godly, you have to believe in God. What do I mean? Because we live in a generation where there is a lot of people actually have become a bit fed up with emptiness. That's the truth. And we're re-experiencing a little bit of a disillusionment with overexposure to hedonism and materialism. And there actually are a lot of people that their soul is cooking, and they actually are looking for meaning. but they're not quite ready to surrender. So they talk about spirituality rather than godliness. Now, spirituality is a very good thing, and spirituality is more conducive to godliness than physicality, true. But spirituality out of God is just another form of self. It's a refined part of self. It might be a deeper part of self. It might be a more meaningful part of self, but it's still self. You're still choosing what works for you. I said it was going to be a challenging topic, demanding topic, right? Because like sounds like, what's wrong? It's still you. So you haven't graduated. You're still stuck. You're still a small horse. You're still stuck in yourself. So my answer always is, to be spiritual, no, you don't have to believe in God. There were plenty of spiritual people, and there are plenty of spiritual people, and I have God. That's you looking for spirituality, which is a more refined form of existence. God created the physical and He created the spiritual. They're both creations. One just a bit more refined than the other. One is more finite than the other. You want to really connect to something infinite? You want to really find meaning and purpose? Foundation is bitul. Foundation is surrender, not to spirituality, but to God. Connected to the discussion I often have with people, right? I often have these people, God, Rabbi, why do you have to keep mitzvot? Just be a good person. Just be a good person, right? That's good enough. Be a good person. What does it mean to be a good person? You know, once had a series, if you remember, it was a long time ago. It's called A Meaningful Life by Hugh Mackay, right? Who came up with an amazing theory, and he was correct. His theory was that to live a life of meaning, that was his theory. He's clearly in his book, so I'm not gossiping or anything, but he makes no secret of the fact that he does not believe in God, and he does not believe in religion, and he doesn't believe in prayer. Fine. Did I ever tell you that after the series, I actually did a book review with him together. I have a signed copy. He signed my book for me. Right? He's a great guy. He's a great psychologist. But I did challenge him a little bit. I mean, I wasn't going to stand up there as a rabbi and tell him I believe everything he says in the book, where he says there's no need to pray, no need to be godly, right? So I couldn't do that. But the book's an amazing book. But the problem is, he talks about meaning only comes from giving, which is true. Because what he did understand is that to find meaning and purpose, meaning brings happiness, purpose and meaning brings happiness, that's true. And he says the only way to find meaning is to give, which what he was really saying is you have to go beyond yourself. The problem is, if all you like to do is give, a lot of people like to give. A lot of people like to help. It doesn't mean that you really left yourself, right? True meaning and inner fulfillment, inner happiness comes from leaving yourself. Leaving yourself doesn't always happen just from giving. Giving is a beautiful thing. But you need, and if that's your emphasis, that's great. And that's like, nurture your strengths, nurture your emphasis. And different types of giving, different forms of giving. But how do you know that your giving is truly selfless? How do you know you've actually really left yourself? So I always get this question, Rabbi, you know, it's enough to be a good person. Together with the question I always get is, how do you find religious Jews that cheat and are dishonest? You know what my answer is? There's no such thing as religious Jew that cheats. But there is. There is. The answer is they're not religious. Right? Just like a person who only is a good person, an honest person, but doesn't do any other mitzvot is not religious. Doesn't claim even to be religious. The person who's religious, I don't know what that means, religious. Religious, I guess, in that question, it's used in the sense of putting on tefillin or keeping Shabbat and so on and so forth. But he cheats other people and defrauds other people. That's not religious. Right? The downside is that those people think they're religious. Okay, that's like a real problem, right? That's not religious. Why? Because religious, in my world at least, religious means being godly. Being godly means to do what God wants. And that's the point here. It comes back to the same point. Because God wants you to do both things. As the mitzvot, as you know, are divided into two parts. What's called ben adam lechaveiro, between man and man, and between man and God. Right? So when the person says it's enough to be a good person, no, it's not enough to be a good person. You have to be a godly person to really leave yourself to find meaning. What does it mean to be a godly person? Just to put on tefillin and keep Shabbat? Of course not. God has 630 mitzvot. Okay, we don't keep all of them today because many of them are connected to the temple. But they divide into two. The tablets, the luchot, the Ten Commandments had two tablets. That's exactly the point. One was between man and God, one was between man and man. right? So therefore, is it true, therefore, that to find purpose, you have to find your strengths? Absolutely, but it's a stage two, not stage one. Stage one is surrendering. And every person has to surrender where they are up to in the journey. I don't ever recommend for people to start keeping all 630 mitzvot in one night, because that's not going to happen. And it's not healthy either, right? But growth, we always talk about growth, is a really critical, growth means going beyond ourselves, is a really critical part of the journey of finding purpose. But growth must mean, real growth is growing into something that maybe I like, but not just something I like and doing more. But it also means choosing something that's hard for me. Choosing something that's beyond me. Choosing something I don't like doing. Choosing a mitzvah that doesn't make any sense to me. And for different people, that might be something, might be different. Why? Because I want to actually really go beyond myself. Once we do that, once we create the foundation, and we start a journey at least, or we move ourselves towards that concept of being godly rather than good, being godly rather than spiritual, being godly in the sense that I'm actually really to leave myself so I can find true purpose, stage two is, okay, now in that godly system that is uniform for everyone, what is my uniqueness? So what is my area of emphasis? Right, so one person might keep all the mitzvot, but their area of emphasis is an organization to help to feed the hungry, whatever. Right, another person might be teaching Torah. Another person might be something else. That's fine, and that's true because every person has a unique mission. That is true. Same thing with the soul, by the way. Right, she talks about the soul being unique from a Kabbalistic point of view. It actually is and it isn't. Every soul is unique, but every soul is the same also at its very core. In other words, what is the soul? Why does the soul drive meaning? Why does the soul drive us to live for a life of meaning? Because the soul is a spark of God. Every soul, at its essence, is connected with the same God. And therefore, at its essence, we're actually all one. So why are we unique then? We're unique in how that essence, that essential spark, is expressed. That's the difference. How it's expressed. And that every person is different. But in order to start a life of meaning where we connect and we access the soul, as she spoke about before, about removing the ego, removing the klipa, to really access the soul, to access the essence of the soul, we must first build the foundation. The foundation is leaving oneself. How does we leave oneself? By being godly. That's not about finding your strength. That's about finding something that God wants us to do and doing it, even though we don't like to do it. It goes back to the chesed and gevurah thing, all of us doing things that are beyond our nature, all of those things. In the Jewish sense, in the Jewish context, it's normally about doing a mitzvah which has no immediate benefit, right? Which a lot of mitzvot are like that. We don't see the meaning. When a man puts on tefillin, or a woman lights Shabbos candles, or puts a mezuzah on the door, whatever the mitzvah might do or might be, right? Or maybe it means not doing something which we're not supposed to do because we rely on God, that He has His own definition of morality and goodness, right? Those things, we don't see the obvious benefit, and that's the greatness of it. The greatness of it is we don't see the meaning there. That's why it's real surrender. And then, once we're ready to do those kind of things, then we also find our own unique mission. The two are not contradictory. One builds on the other. Because God does have a unique mission for each one of us. That is true. Which kind of links... kind of links to the next chapter in the book, which I'll just sort of touch on, which is a beautiful idea, where she talks about the power of action, the power of doing. She talks first of all about a grandmother who was saved from Auschwitz, because what happened was she was on the train, on the transport, and she knew that they're going into something really, really bad. So she found a crack in the train, as we find stories about that sometimes, and she jumped. Right, but she jumped and injured herself, but eventually did survive. And then later found out that train had gone to Auschwitz and everyone had been exterminated. Right, so she knew instinctively that she had to get off the train. So she just forced herself and just took the jump. So she took that as a model for a very beautiful thing. She says in her own anxiety, and when she went to sort of, you know, she traveled and she talks about a trip where she went with her husband and just was full of anxiety, just really really hard. She was full of fear and full of anxiety. As a lot of the book describes her anxiety. And she tells a story, it's a beautiful story, and it connects to a certain concept which we've talked about before, but the imagery, the way she describes it, is very beautiful. I'm going to share it with you. She says, after the Paris incident, which was that trip that she was full of, you know, she was supposed to go on a holiday with her husband, and it ended up a disaster because she was full of panic attacks the whole time, right? She says, after that incident, while fear was still controlling my life, I was walking home from London Underground, the London Underground station, one Friday afternoon. And she describes how Friday afternoon was always hard for her in England because, even though she didn't come from a religious background at all, but Friday afternoon in Israel somehow had a certain energy which was different to the way it was in England. She always used to be there. On that particular evening, the sun was going down and I could smell the subtle change in the air that marks the shift from winter to spring. The skies were orange and it was quite mild. I was annoyed with myself. Such a gorgeous evening, and I still couldn't shake my depression, my fear. Suddenly, I heard a group of young men singing a song that made me slow down until I froze. It was a song I had heard many times before. I'm sure some people have heard the song. I've heard it as a child growing up in Israel. We sang it on school trips, at summer camp, in the military, when running up the hills of northern Israel and navigating the desert down south and so on. Right? Most Jewish children knew the song. It was part of Jewish culture. Now, the song was actually made by the famous Rav Nachman of Breslov. And the song, I'm sure some of you know the song, is Kol HaOlam Kulo Gesher Tzar Me'od. Okay, right? For those who don't know, so the song goes, I'm not going to sing it for you, but the song goes, right? Huh? The whole world is Geshert Tzar Me'od, is a narrow bridge. And Rabbi Blessed said, Ve'aikar, the main thing is, Lo lefached klal, not to be afraid. In other words, cross the bridge, right? And she said, and she heard a bunch of, I don't know, must have been a bunch of people that were on a trip or something, they were singing the song. And she said, that evening those familiar words touched me. Yes, the world was a narrow bridge. My internal world was terrifying. Life stretched out before me like a steep, uncontrolled, unconquerable path, like a bridge too narrow to cross. How could one have no fear at all? The song wasn't just asking me to learn to cope with my anxiety. It was asking me to have no fear at all. And then she says, later on, she didn't know that at the time, but later on she realized and she learned that that song was inspired by Rabbi Breslov, by the Nachman of Breslov, who lived at the end of the 1700s. Rabbi Nachman of Breslov writes a lot about a lot of, it seems from what he's writing is that he went through a lot of anxiety himself, and he went through a lot of challenges and so on and so forth. And he came to this conclusion, which he then expressed in the song, which became the song, right? And he left us with this piece of wisdom. He said that if you encounter a very narrow bridge, which is terrifying, there's only one way to conquer it. Action. Cross the bridge. Just cross it. Just do it. Just jump.
Like now, you can just do it.
Just do it, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Right? Very, very symbolic of what the Talmud tells, by the way. The Talmud tells us that's exactly what happened when the Jews came to the Red Sea. And God had told them to go to Mount Sinai, and they came to the sea, there was nowhere to go. And God said, V'yisa'u, they should travel. There's a destination, there's Har Sinai. And the Talmud says that eventually Nachshon ben Aminadab, one of the leaders of one of the tribes, he jumped into the sea and just kept going until the water hit his neck and the sea split. Because that's what life is, right? Life is, we are trapped in a narrow bridge, and we're trapped in a narrow bridge because that narrow bridge actually is not the world. And he says, Kol ha'olam kulo, the whole world, it's not just the whole world, it's our world. We are a narrow bridge. We ourselves are a narrow bridge. Our ego is a narrow bridge. Because we are very small. That's part of the problem with ego. We are very, very small. Right? We are tiny. And therefore, to overcome narrow bridge, it becomes very scary. And putting in the context of that discussion before, it is very scary to leave ourselves. That's why in today's world, people are becoming less and less resilient, less and less strong, less and less willing to be uncomfortable. And crossing the narrow bridge is becoming more and more petrifying. And what you realize was, you have to replace fear with action. As we've talked about many times, that the consciousness of a human being is on three levels. That's the way we think, the way we feel, our emotions, and action, the way we behave. And the emotions are the hardest. Our emotions, where all the trouble is, the fear, the anxiety, the depression, the challenges, the anger, the everything, all lives in our emotion, and that's what cannot be changed. Only one way to change it from either side. We have to fix our pattern of thinking, which is not the discussion of today. The way we think, the way we process information, the way we interpret that which is going on around us. Right? But the other way to do it is from the other side. Action. As the Sefer HaChinuch says, we've talked about this many times, that when you do something, it influences the way you feel. Right? Our heart follows our actions. So we have to take a plunge. Kol Alam Kolo, the whole world is a small bridge. It's difficult to cross that bridge. It's terrifying to do something that doesn't fit with us. We don't want to leave ourselves. Then we rationalize it. It doesn't talk to me. It doesn't fit with me. It doesn't kind of gel with me. It's not me. It's not my instincts. It's not my gut. It's not this. My own truth. You know, there's a new thing now. People are living their own truth. I don't know what that means, own truth. How can a person have truth? There's only one truth, my. God is truth, right? Emet is God. There's not only one true truth. My truth, your truth. It's all my. Everything's about my, right? So that's a rationale, but what's at the heart of it? The heart of it is because it's scary. It's scary to surrender. It's scary to leave ourselves. As I said in the first lesson, 4/5 of the Jewish nation didn't want to go out of Egypt. They were living a life of oppression and slavery, and you know what 4/5 mean? There were like 3 million people that left. That makes the maths not very good. Is 12 million people didn't leave. 12 million people didn't want to leave Israel. They died. Another discussion. It's a very interesting pace-up discussion. Right? Yeah. 12 million people died during the plague of darkness. Right? Yeah, they didn't leave. The nation was a fifth. They left, a fifth of the Jewish nation left. 4 million. And even the part that did leave, as soon as something went wrong, oh, why do we leave Egypt? Right? Because it's hard to surrender. It's very hard. We're so trapped in that narrow bridge. There's only one way to do it. Lo lefached klal. It's got to cross the bridge. We all have to, when I say we all, I mean we. All of us. Everyone. We all have to, if we want to really find meaning, want to really find purpose, we all have to, once in a while, not every day, once in a while, upgrade. Upgrade to something that is terrifying, that is hard for us to do, that doesn't talk to us, that doesn't make sense, that seems pointless, and yet God wants us to do it, so we do it, and that's how we surrender. Second stage is, obviously, then we look for the things that is us. And in that context, because once we surrender, then when we find purpose in our strengths, it's a whole different ballgame. We're operating.
Why do they do things that you don't want to do? Are you only referring to this
book? I'm referring to things that, yes, I'm referring to things that are godly.
Only, yes.
Yeah, but most times.
Things that you don't feel comfortable doing in a day to day, they think, okay, I'm going to do this because I don't like it, but I'm going to do it.
So the truth is that most things like that are godly. Most things, right? like, for example, even if it's solving a conflict with someone,
yeah.
Right? That you don't want to have the conversation, you don't want to say sorry, you don't want to apologize, you don't want to resolve it, it's too difficult, so I'm going to escape. That's definitely part of the Torah, it's very godly, right? But what I was saying before is that it shouldn't only be that, because then we trap ourselves again into the, I'm only going to do things that enhance relationships. So yes, it could be in something like that too, but it's also good to do something that is just purely God, I mean, not purely godly, but like on the between man and God level, because then it really doesn't make any sense to us. Like, it's very hard. And that's part of the surrender. But then, what the point I'm trying to bring out is, after that, when we start doing things that are our strengths, and we do it because we're a different person then. Once you surrender, you're a different person. Then even the things that even the purpose we find that are nurturing and expressing the unique strengths that we have are enhanced and much more infinite, and the potential is much greater. Because we've tamed our ego a little bit. Once you've tamed your ego, they leave, because a lot of people do things that they're very good at and end up a disaster. Why? Because they just can't leave themselves.
Example.
Sorry?
Do we have a tangible example of a man and God that doesn't make a lot of sense to us?
Changing for
Pesach. Yeah, keeping Pesach?
Yeah.
That's
true.
It could be.
No,
many mitzvot. I'm happy to give you examples afterwards. You want a real good one? Okay. Kashrut. Not only one go. Kashrut is very hard, and it makes no sense, right? And if you really ask the question, I'd recommend that. Like, let's say a person saying, at least at home, I'll only eat kosher meat. Even that's a step. Or if someone's already doing that, see me later. I'll give you suggestions how to proceed. No, of course, it's also chesed and gevurah. So, I mean, Well, yeah, kashrut has symbolism of chesed and gevura because you have the meat and the milk. The meat is gevura and the milk is chesed, and yeah, that's for another longer discussion. But that's an idea. But it's again, you know why I say kashrut? Because kashrut is one of the many, but one, it's an example, one example of something that actually we don't know the real reason. There's symbolisms, there's interpretation, there's mystical ideas. The real reason we don't know. The Torah says not to steal. That's rational. Yeah. On your parents, rational.
Yeah.
Right? That's something we really actually. That's one of the chukim. Right? But it's a really important step. It's not clearly brought in the book. It's an important step to do something like that. That gets us beyond who we are. And then everything else we do becomes much more enhanced and much more strengthened. More to come.